Rehearsed interview with Mrs. Dorothy Butler of Maize Lick, Kentucky. The interview is being held on January 20th, 1988. The interviewer is Lynn David. Just visit here.
Okay.
You were born Dorothy O'Rourke.
Dorothy O'Rourke.
And you told me you were born on Mill Creek?
Mill Creek. That's a creek that empties into the north fork of the Licking River. And it's a small place, a small little creek. And it was my parents. And,
parents' names?
My father was John Lee O'Rourke. And my mother was Mary Devereaux O'Rourke. And they were married in 1902. And I was the sixth child. They had lost one before. I was the sixth child, I guess. I really, I was the fifth child.
There was John and Adelaide.
John and then Owen, and he died. And then Paul. Then Annalee, and then me. And so I was the fifth child, and my mother ended up in dying in September the 13th, 1923, and in childbirth, the baby died. My mother's death. Annalee was 14 and I was 12, and she was a sophomore in high school, and I was the Lewisburg school was just being built at that time, and we were going to go to the Lewisburg school, but it wasn't quite finished. That was when the consolidation of all the one-room schools, and I was to be in the seventh grade, and Annalee had started to Maize Lick at the she was a sophomore, and she'd been going to school since Labor Day, which was perhaps around the 5th or 6th, and but she had to withdraw from school and be the mother of the house at 14. You can't hardly imagine that now. And back in those days, they raised big crops, and I know my father really must have had it hard, really, really. And but we were lucky. There was a at that time we always said a colored woman, and we loved her dearly. But and so she did the she come once a week and did the washing. But Annalee and I together did the other, and Joe was only. He was just 3 at that time. Tom was 5 and Margaret was 7. And for 25 years I called him Father Jimmy. So now I can't hardly go back and just say Jimmy. So he was 9 and I was 12. And the oldest one, John, my oldest brother, was 19. So it was and had a bachelor uncle that lived with us all that time. And we had to walk 2.5 miles to get the school bus. And I never remember of us ever missing any school, because Dad would take 2 tobacco sticks and go in front of us and break away to get us out to the school bus. Then in 1926, we moved. Dad was a tenant farmer, and the place was sold. So he rented another place, which put us in the Maize Lick School District. So that's where I started to in the sophomore year at Maize Lick. And that's where I graduated then in 1929. And that's where I met my husband. He was with me. We were out sophomore, junior, and senior together.
His name was
Nathan Butler. And we didn't start dating until senior year, about just a little before Christmas. He gave me, I think it might have been a dollar and a quarter necklace for Christmas. And that told me that. So, but it was we were in the Deep Depression at that time, you know, and you just it was really it was hard on everybody, rich as well as the poor, and especially tenant farmers. And my dad and the boys continued to raise the crop. But what I like to think is so notable and so commendable, Ann Lee was really an excellent student. And even though she had to quit in the second or third year, week of her sophomore year, she never once gave up the idea that she was going to be a dropout. So once Tom and Joe got started in school, she enrolled in the Chicago School of Correspondence School. And I might say that at that time, I think her books cost long about $75, and you had to, that was for 2 years. She was going to take 2 years. And she had to pay, I think it was $60 a year at that time to get enrolled. And then they mailed her, and she did all the work. And then she would mail it back, and it would be graded and then sent back to her. So she was an excellent student. And then in order to really get a high school diploma, you at that time, you were required to go to a high school your senior year. You had to take your senior year. So we were living in the Maeslick School District, but at that time, Maeslick was what was called a double A school, and they were not allowed. It was one of the, I think Maeslick and Maysville were the only two that in this whole area that were a double A school. And
you know what that meant?
It was the highest that they could that you could attain. It was the highest grade that a school could get, and they it fixed them in a way that a graduate would be accepted, they had to be accepted at any college in the Southern Association without any questions asked and any tests or anything like that if you graduated from a AA school. And so naturally, to achieve that, there was some specifications put on them, and that was one that they could not accept. But Lewisburg School was just an A school, and they could. And we were fortunate that we lived right close to the railroad, and both school buses from Maeslick turned at the railroad and Lewisburg turned at the railroad. So she was accepted at the Lewisburg school. She went to Lewisburg, and the rest of us went to Maeslick because we were in that district.
So she would ride the train then every day?
No, she'd ride the school bus.
I see.
She'd ride the school bus. The two school buses turned at the same gate, and she would ride the Lewisburg school buses, and we both graduated in 1929, even though she had been out all those years. See, I was just in the seventh grade when our mother died. And she was in the 10th grade, and she'd been out of school all that time, but she went back, and she finished right in the top of her class. She was really a brilliant young lady. So we were always really proud of that. And but then, when we graduated, to say it was right in the height of the Depression, and you just really would had to live through the Depression to really know just what it was and the sacrifices. But as I grow older, it's something I've never regretted that I lived through it, because it really taught you something. You will be the best lessons you ever learned, and most people that went through the Depression will tell you that your best lessons you ever learned. You appreciate things, you save things, you're not wasteful, you just you know what could happen again, you know. And then when we got out of school, then she got her a job in Maysville, and I took over the house, because I then by that time, see, I was 18, and then I took over the house. And then it's when Just before we graduated is when Nathan and I started really seriously dating. And I've often wondered how things worked out. He was an extremely brilliant, especially in math. And his father at that time had just moved back to their place in Bath County. They had only been down here since he was 10. And so his father had moved back to place in Bath County. That made him eligible for a scholarship in the Berea. So he got a scholarship in mathematics to go to college. Well, of course, we were just torn apart. I really wanted him to get a college education, but I didn't want him to go either. And he was the same way. And as I say, you often think about how faith turns your life. So, you know where Frances Guildhall lives, the postmistress, you know, Frances Guildhall's place. It's off of the, it's right across from Joe Jolly's mother, Aunt Elizabeth. Well, Aunt Elizabeth was just a little girl at that time, and her father died. In fact, I think he was buried about the time we graduated. They had cows, like a 9 or 10 cows, and Mrs. Pogue had the two daughters, Aunt Elizabeth and Frances. Aunt Elizabeth later married Joe Jolly, and Frances married Rice, and Helena, they'll come to me in a few minutes what his name is. And so they came and prevailed upon Nathan for a little while to take over until she could do better. Well, before school. So when he went, he really went with the intention of just milking the cows until school would start. He had all his things lined up to go to college in Berea. But he liked the job. By that time, we had 3 more serious months of courting. So he just decided to stay. And he stayed there the 3 years, and he raised the tobacco and milked the cows. And did the general farm work, managed the farm for, and then that put it up until 1932, and then we married. And
did he continue to work for her after you were married?
For that lady? No. By that time, her cows were getting older, and she didn't really want to keep in the cow. So. And his father had just moved then from Bath County down on Tuckahoe, and they took on a big, big crop. So Nathan went back home with his dad then in March, and the tobacco was stripped, and the cows were sold. So he went back, he moved from Maeslick down on Tuckahoe Ridge. I don't know whether you're familiar, that's down the western part, down toward, it goes on close to Dover. So they raised a big tobacco crop down there. And that was when we married on the first day of June of 1932. And there was no money to go housekeeping, so you just had to live with one of the other parents. And since he was farming with his father, why it was only feasible, logical, that we would live with his mother and father. So that's what we did, but
you lived in the same house.
In the same house, just as a family unit. And at that time, he had a younger brother, sister, and then this youngest brother, which was 10. He had 2 brothers and a sister living at home. So we went with the understanding that we would just finish out that crop year. That way, it gave his dad chance, because the ordinary renting time around this area was July, and that would give his dad, he would know that he was going to lose one of his helpers, and then he could cut down on some of the tobacco. And they lived on Miss Nanny Bacon's place, and we were looking for a place, and I kind of wanted to come back closer to Mays Lick. And I really didn't tell anybody that. It was just in my mind. I didn't even tell Nathan, because I knew wherever we could rent a place, we'd have to, you know, we'd take it. And then the place down that where Jack and Phoebe Collins lived, you know where that is? Well, that was the Blatterman's down on 68, and that was the Blatterman. And Jack Collins' uncle, which was a bachelor, Lawrence Mannion, he bought that summer. And he was living back at their home place. And his father was old, up in the 80s, and was ailing. And he didn't want to leave his home place. And he had a sister that wasn't too well. So they wanted to rent that. So he came down and asked us, would we rent that and raise the crop farm the next year? Well, somehow I had kind of had hopes that we could get a place where we could milk a few cows. That kept every 2 weeks, you'd get a check coming in. And I had known that from when Nathan was milking from Miss Ollie Poe, because that furnished just the dating money. back in that time, you could ride all afternoon on $1.50 a gas, you know, and you could... a movie, even though it would be only maybe 35 or 40 cents, you just didn't dare, because you'd better use that for gas to get home. So I would have liked to have had a place that was cows, but it wasn't. So when he told us how much tobacco, I think it was like, I think it was 9.5 acres of tobacco we were to grow. I'd never worked out, never had done anything, because we had five brothers and they had all lived at home. And we had enough raising the three younger children, and we were never knew what it was to do anything outside. And so I knew I couldn't take a hand, although at that time a lot of women were beginning to go out and help husbands, you know, in the field, but I knew I couldn't. And so my two brothers were home, and Dad and Uncle Bill told them, well, it'll give you all a little more money, so if you all go with it. So we rented that house and the land, and so we started housekeeping there. On the, I started out with, instead of one man, I had three men. And
you never were alone with him,
Never in all our married life. We had 3 days alone together on our honeymoon. That is really a factual thing, 3 days. So we were happy though, and John and Paul was very, very congenial, and they really, Nathan was the only in-law in the family, and they really accepted him and really, really loved him well, so we got along very fine. But, then that year, a cousin of ours bought this place. And
who owned this place?
Well, it was the Hanley, Jim Hanley, and his wife Ida. And he died suddenly with a massive heart attack in February. And by, I think, first or second day of February, and we had just moved to that place, and Buddy Mannion's place, where Jack and Phoebe Collins now live. So Uncle Benny, we called him Uncle because he was the same age of our father, and it was sort of considered to be disgraceful in those times to call them by their first name, you know. So if you had a first cousin, or your father's first cousin, you tagged on aunt and uncle to him. So that's why we called him Uncle. And he come up and asked us, if he bought this place, could we come here the next year? So we said yes. And well, we talked it over with John and Paul. And by that time, John had gotten an offer to go to Walls in Maysville. But he was already tied up with the crops, so he had to finish out that crop, you know. And and Paul had two or three places that he could get a job, so it worked out very nicely for all of us. And we just lived at that house the 1 year, and then we moved out here on February the 28th, 1934, and we didn't live in this house. It was not built. It was a little house back there, and we moved into it. And then it burned in 1965. So then, as I say, I started out with not one man, but with three men. Then in September, this Uncle Denny Mackey, he came up, and he was looking for a place around Mays Lick. And he came out up, and he asked me if he could come up here and live. So there I had four men, all at once. And so you can see I couldn't do any outside work. I had four men. So he lived with us then from around the first two or three days. It was still tobacco housing time, so I know it was around the first few days of September. And he lived with us then until he bought this place. And well, he lived on until we moved here. Then the next year, he lived the whole time with us until we moved here the next year then. And then we moved out here on February the 28th, 1934. But we knew at the time we moved that we were getting a new house in the deal. And in fact, the plans were all drawn up down at the other house where Jack and Phoebe Collins now live. That's where they live. And so they started the first bit of sand, and everything was hauled for this March the 15th, 1935. And oh, I was so happy, my, to think I was going to get into a new house. But of course, now we didn't have electricity, we didn't have running water then. But right now, I'm sitting on top of the cistern this year. And it was wired, of course, we knew it would become by that time. I believe it was 34 or 35 that the RECC Roosevelt started. And I think it was 1934. So we knew eventually that we would. So this house was completely wired when it was built because they knew it would be advantageous to do it. And we had a handle pump right here over this, but then we had what we call a prime pump in the kitchen. And oh, I thought I was really up in G, you know, that all I had to do was up and down, had water right in the kitchen sink, when most people had to go out and carry in a, and we also built the starting of the bathroom. And no running water and no heat in it, but at least you could heat your water. In summertime, all you had to do was take it off of here and in, put it in the tub, and by the time you got ready to take a bath, it'd be warm, you know, it's summertime. So we really felt like that we were way above the average, and we were. We really were living way above the average in a brand new house. And so then pretty soon after we were here, when I got pregnant, and our first child was born in March 15th, 1935, and we named him Nathan. So he's now heading for 53. He'll be 53 the 15th of March. And we really were happy, and Uncle Denny continued to live with us, and he helped out, you know, little chores. He helped strip tobacco, but he was not a bit well. And he wasn't able to do too much, but just enough to keep himself occupied and busy. And then the second child was born, Larry, Lawrence Mackey. We named him, we called him Larry. I don't know why we dobbed a nickname on all of our children. I suppose Dolores is the only one that has always been called by our name. Nady, we started out, because it would be so confusing. And Nathan was really, he was the only Nathan for years and years in this county until Nady came along. And then they were the only two. And now there's, I imagine perhaps there's 18, 20, maybe even more, because every once in a while, Nathan has become a sort of a fad name.
That's a pretty name.
Uh-huh. It was after Nathan the prophet, you know. And some people say it's a Jewish, has a diversion of Jew, and I'm sure that it probably is, because I remember so distinctly, of course, those days, children were all barn, or most of them were barn in the home. Very few was ever thought about being barn in the hospital. And Dr. Wynn Hoard was our doctor. And when he came back to fix out the, he's our Maysville's mayor's father, Mayor Harry Cardinal, she's his oldest daughter. He was a wonderful doctor. And when he came out to fix out the birth certificate, and Nathan's name was Nathan Wesley. And he had got that from his uncle. He had from two uncles. He had an uncle, Nathan Buffer, and had an uncle, and then his grandfather was Wesley Arrowsmith. So that's where he got the Nathan Wesley. And of course, that Wesley derived from John Wesley, the good Methodist man. So Dr. Hoard knew all that. And when he took down the name for the birth certificate, and he was writing it down, and he took down Nathan Wesley Butler, Mother Dorothy Marie O'Rourke, and child's name, Nathan Wesley Butler Jr. He said, "Well, what are we coming to here? Here we got Irish Catholic and Methodist and Jew all in one little tiny which of course he did." But I said, "Well, that's the way it is." It's so I wasn't at that time wasn't thinking ecumenically like we are today, you know, because after all, that's been 53 years ago or almost. And then, as I say, Larry, his was Lawrence Mackey, because we named him after Uncle Denny. And I kind of like family names as a second name. I just sort of had a preference to that, so I named him Lawrence Mackey. And immediately, they started calling him Larry, and so today, he's Larry. And, of course, on his Social Security and his working and everything like that is... But I do believe his checks are Larry. I believe his banking is still Larry. And then in 15 months, we were graced with another son, and we named him Gerald Lee. I just particularly like the name of Gerald, no particular reason. And then my father's name was Lee, so I named him after John Lee. And by the way, my father was born in 1865. And he was a real broad-shouldered man, and some of our children have followed that. And even as an infant, the lady that was with his mother when he was born, and she, back in those days, you didn't dare think about bathing a baby or doing anything for 10 days or 2 weeks. So whoever was with you, or at least some neighbor lady or someone, come and bathe the baby for the mother. So when she came to bathe Dad, as Grandma always told it, she went on and on about his fine, robust chest and his broad shoulder. And after she got him bathed, before she dressed him one day, she held him in her hand and she says, "Why, he looks just like General Lee." So his name was John. But he never knew it. He was always was called Lee. And in later years, he did kind of put the John on as John Lee, but he never on checks, right, banking, or anything. Church, everything, he was always Lee O'Rourke. And he was named after General Lee. So, and strange, almost everybody in there's an awful lot of Lees then have followed right on in our family. And right away, he was dubbed as Jerry. Right today, he is Jerry. And then his son is Gerald Lee II, and he's one that graduated from Mason County last year. He was such a good ball player. But we do distinguish them two. He's Jerry Lee, and his daddy is Jerry.
Is it about to call?
No. So we really got in deep trouble after Jerry was born. He was just 4 months old when I become very, very ill. We really thought for some time that I wasn't going to make it. had a hard time finding out what was wrong with me. I just an unbearable headache. And everything I'd eat, I'd vomit. And lost pounds. After I got up and about, well, the day or two after I first got sick, I weighed 132 pounds. And that was about Thanksgiving time, a few days before Thanksgiving, because I know I was in bed on Thanksgiving Day, and I weighed 132 pounds, and I was operated on the 14th of January, and I weighed 87. Mm. So I just went to nothing. And it was a toxic garter, and it hung right in below the collarbone. And it had ruptured when I was as near death as.
That was awful. But the little ones are especially around.
So who kept care of the little ones?
Well, we were lucky. At that time, we still had the colored woman had been helping me all those years. Well, she still came and did the laundry.
What was her name?
Lily Bolden. And I loved her dearly. And then we got another woman to come and stay in the house. But of course, now that would be confining to stay there. Was by that time, Uncle Denny began to reach the semi-invalid. Nady was five. Larry was a year and a half. He was all getting close to two, and 18 or 19 months. And Jerry, 4 months old. So after a couple of weeks, she asked me, could she take 1 week and her daughter take the next week. So that's what we did, and it worked out. And when I was dismissed from the Samaritan Hospital in Cincinnati, the doctor said I could not do anything for 1 year.
For a year?
For 1 year. And you just thought, well, that was impossible. With that size family and a baby, well, actually two babies, because Larry was still in with the bottle, still in diapers. And you just thought, well, it was impossible. But it wasn't. And the doctor told Nathan, and he told me too, he said, you won't live if you don't. Because something about removing the garter, and it was Dr. Jody Corsi. He was supposed to be this whole Midwest, the best. And they take out part of the parathyroid, and then they're all the nerves and everything is centered in there. And one that is real close, and if you're just become a nervous wreck, even just sometimes lose their mind and everything. He said, you just won't make it if you don't. So we said, well, we'll just take it a day at a time and do the best we could. So we did. And just before the year was up, this lady had to, her daughter got pregnant and she got ill and she had to go, but the year was about up. So then we just got the Lily to come more often, and then we got another colored girl to come. And so I made it. And then it was, then that was in 1941 that I had, and then Dolores was born in December of 1942. And luckily she was healthy as she could be and everything, and was fine. Everything was fine with me. And then we had another reprieve. Donnie wasn't born until June the 30th. And his name was, better go back, Dolores is Dolores Marie. And nobody dared ever dive a nickname on her. Well, then Donnie, his name is Donald Carroll. And immediately we all had all these IEs, so he became Donnie. And then everything went along nice and smooth. And Uncle Denny, though, he became worse immediately. He had a prostate operation. And we really had it rough for 14 or 15 months with him, and he died in April of 1947. And he was bedfast most of the time, and I had to feed him everything he ate. So I just had to continue with the household help all that time, and then he died in April of 1947, April the 24th. And then that was the first time we had ever been alone as a family. Yeah. And from 32 until 47. So then we had just our family. And by that time though, the war was over. And Tom, my brother that ended up living with us so long, he came to live a year with us. And then he went back down to the home, and the boys raised big crops, and then eventually he went back to service and didn't get out then until 61. Then in 1953, Uncle Bill was ailing and was real frail. And now Father's...
Who's Uncle Bill?
That's the bachelor uncle that had lived with us all our life. And then all the... Both of my sisters had done married, and they were out on their own, so it was just all the men folks still at home by then. And my brother, that kind of later become a priest, he had just stifled his desire to go to the seminary because of family pressure and family duty, and he stayed with Dad until Dad died. I think I missed that. Dad died October the... 1943, right in the height of the war. And by that time, Uncle Bill had really gotten frail. So Jimmy seen no way of getting away again. And but then Tom was back in the service, and Joe came to live with us. And so Jimmy went to the seminary. He was 39 years old when he went and decided, finally got his act together and got accepted and all into the seminary. And he too was a brilliant student, so he ordinarily it takes 9 years to become a priest, but he made it in good in 8, and he graduated from Catholic University in Washington, magna cum laude, and was ordained in 1960. So I'll go back now to Donnie. Donnie was born back in 1946, and Uncle Denny died in 1947. And then, by that time, I knew that there wasn't going to be any O'Rourkes left in Mason County. So when Dickie was born, or Richard, because there we only had one brother that was married. Out of the five, we only had one that was married. And I could remember so distinctly when we were at home and my mother was still living, all those boys around, and when neighbors and relatives would come, they would always say to Dad and Mom, they said, well, the name of O'Rourke will never leave Mason County, all these boys. But here we were, all those years later, and only one of them married, and he'd been married some time, and no children. And here, both of my sisters were married to Gallensteins, and I was married to a butler, and there was a butler and a Gallenstein coming every year or two, but no O'Rourkes. And we ended up with 7 children, and Margaret and Leroy Gallenstein had 16, 8 boys and 8 girls. And my sister Anna Lee had married Victor Gallenstein. She had 4, 2 girls and 2 boys. So I thought, well, gee, time is running out on us. So I was named Dickie. My grandfather's name was Richard, and Nathan's grandfather's name was Richard. So we thought that was very timely to name him Richard after his 2 grandfathers, and then I put that O'Rourke on it. And he doesn't sign his name as Richard O'Rourke, because that's a pretty long name, but he does hold on to that O, and he always puts his apostrophe up on there. So he is Richard O, but never, that is in on his on all his legal papers and his Social Security and all his checks, his teacher check and everything, he's Richard. But even his students, the next day if they get out of school, he's Dickie to them too, and he's Dickie to all of us. And he so then we I thought perhaps he, by that time I was getting older, and I thought perhaps, well, there wouldn't be any more, so I'd better put an O'Rourke in there for. And so he went some years that was the only one. But now one of Margaret's girls, John Cleese, they have one that has O'Rourke in it, so I'm glad for that. It is a middle name. And so then in 1954, of course, I guess it was late 50, it was 54, because Tommy was born August the 16th, 1954. And I hoped and against hope that I have another girl here. I had all those boys, you know, and I better not let Tommy know that I really shouldn't have said that. But I did secretly, you know, I wanted for myself and I wanted it for Dolores, because it was just a common thing that everybody would say, oh, I feel so sorry for that one little girl with all them brothers. But now she never felt. She just really loved every one of them, and they did her too. And she right in the middle, and she tuned in so nicely with the 3 older ones, and she did just as nicely or a little bit better with the 3 younger ones. And hadn't thought too much what I, well, I really hadn't thought thoroughly of it, but I sort of had the name of Marion, had Tommy been a girl, because it was the Marion year. And then I wanted to remember my mother. Her name was Aloysius, Mary Aloysius. So I actually was going, had he been a girl, I was going to baptize him Mary Aloysius, the same name as my mother. And he was a boy, and we've never regretted it, and we're so proud of him and thankful, and he was good and healthy, and that was all once he was born. Any desire for a girl left immediately when they told us it's a boy. So we wondered for a day or two what we'd name him, and we came up that it just so happened that I had a brother named Thomas, and I had a brother named Edward, and Nathan had a brother named Thomas, and he had a brother named Edward. So we named him Thomas Edward, and that way he was after, and by that time I was 43. So I felt like he really would be the last, and he was. He was the last. And we've always been really proud of all of them. They've all done well. They're all certainly self-supporting. We've never had no broken homes, no hints of broken homes, and they are all, each one of them is just as competent as the other, that they have the best wife in the world. were I to pick the best, I couldn't do it, because they all really do have lovely wives, And then, of course, Dolores married Joe Donovan, and she has a wonderful husband. So so then Tommy went to college for 3 years, two and a half years, and then he just couldn't make up his mind what he wanted to be. Now, all the rest, they adapted pretty good after they got out. In fact, Dolores knew exactly she wanted to be a nurse from the time she was in the fifth grade. Well, Vicki, he knew, and I knew from the time he was fifth or sixth grade, that he should be something in woodwork, carpentry, because he is so gifted and so talented and everything. So he knew he wanted to go to college. Donnie knew he wanted to be a teacher. Well, Larry was a great dairyman, and he went to the University of Kentucky a year, and then he was sent up to Chicago on a work ship, and he worked up there with dairies. But it just, by that time, economically, had gotten so bad and so expensive to set up dairying. And this farm wasn't large enough to support a large enough dairy operation that he and his daddy both could have. And see, we still had several children to get out of high school. Even Tommy was just, hadn't even started, I guess, Tommy hadn't even started to school then, and when he came back. And so he worked with American Breeders Association for a while, and then he got a job with Goodyear in West Virginia. He's been there ever since. And Nady, he went to the University of Kentucky 1 year, and then they were drafting him right and left, so he jumped the gun and he enlisted. And then he was in the Army 2 years, and then he married, and when he came back, he was home for a while, and then they went to Cincinnati. And I believe his first job was with Ford Motor. And he may have better stayed with it, but he thought he didn't like it, and they got a chance to, he and his brother-in-law bought a store, a delicatessen. And he was there quite some time, and I forget just how many years, and he ended up with General Motors anyway. And he was about 19 years with General Motors, and he was in the bunch when it closed. And so I don't know what the outcome will be with him, but he was getting close to retirement, you know, and they, of course, do get 95% of their pay for 2 years. So that will, he won't be too bad off. At that time, he will be close to 55, and he can take an early retirement. Jerry, he's still with Brownings. He's been 19 years with Brownings, and he is real happy with his job. Dolores graduated in 1963 from St. Joseph's, and she had a hospital in Lexington. Then she went to Cincinnati and worked in Good Samaritan there until, 68, and she had married in 65. And then they decided to come back to Maysville. Joe's father had died, and they had quite a bit of holdings. And so he came back, and then they stayed with his mother just 1 year until she adapted. Then he went to Brownings, and she went back to the hospital. And they tried painlessly to have a child, and she'd gone through every kind of test. And nothing could be found, but finally in 1972 she did get pregnant and had one little girl. Maria was born in January, but the rest of them have big families. Nady had eight, and Larry just had three. Jerry has three. Dolores has one, and Donnie has five, and Dickie has three, and Tommy has one. And when Tommy ended up in going to the Army after he had 2.5 years of college, he went to the Army, and he was in San Antonio, and he took a liking to paramedics, so he got in the paramedic, and he then he was sent to Germany, and he was still a paramedic in Germany, and but they seen that he liked he liked that he liked that field, so they got him into a hospital. And I suppose you would, I don't know what the Army called it, but I suppose in lay language here, we would say he would be about like a nurse aide. And he worked in his last 2 years in the hospital over there. And he married a lovely, lovely German girl. And their little boy was born while he was still in Germany, Michael. And he's the only one that has Nathan. He's Michael Nathan. And so then they came back to, he had all the paperwork ready. They wanted him to take the LPN course. So he came back and to the States in October of 83. And he went immediately to San Antonio. Well, he stayed about 2 or 3 weeks here. Then his wife and baby stayed here with me then until January, and he got all enrolled and got started in the LPN class at San Antonio there. And then he, when the school closed down at Christmas, he got the full 2 weeks. So he came back and he took his family then to San Antonio. And oh, did I miss that
I
baby? Because they were such a godsend to me. Because my brother that had been with me all those years and had milked the cows and taken care of the farm, he suddenly died, had a massive hemorrhage, and he died the 31st of January, and they came in October. So I got by pretty good in the summer, and I really hadn't made up my mind just whether I could stay here in the winter or not, you know.
Yeah.
But they came, and they just bridged the gap. And then they didn't leave until January. And he went ahead and finished his LPN course. And last April the 11th, he graduated. Top in his class, he got the top honors. And Dolores and I flew down. And we were so proud of him. So now he has he's working on his RN and his BSN. And he had 97 hours of college work. And 71 of them are accepted in the BSN class. So
great.
It'll be about a year and a half before he has them both, because of course he still has to pay his duty to Uncle Sam, and he does his work, and then he will be taking his courses from the University of El Paso. He's in El Paso. Then he will have to go to Long Beach, California, for the final, and he thinks it'll be about a year and a half when he'll get the BSN, and then he takes the RN after that. So he's planning on making a career of it. I think he's in, he must be in about his ninth year now, and his wife likes it, and he loves it better than anything he has ever done. He really loves that nursing field, and in fact, he's even at this time planned on staying in 26 years, and all of the high-up officials advising to retire at the 26th if he makes it, because they say if you go on to the 30th, your life is going to get sour, and the benefits are very little after the 26th. Between 26 and 30, they tell him they're very little, and so that's his plans now, and but when he comes out with his BSN and his RN, he'll and he loves nursing. He really loves it. He'll be set.
Oh yeah.
So I have no.
Children have all done just fine.
They've all done.
You done good.
Well, that's
you and
they
your
have.
Husband.
Well, we. I really like to think we did. And even though I tell them, and it's true. When we married, we had $50.
That was quite a bit.
Well,
the 30s.
And that's right. It really was. That was what we possessed. And we were happy. And then Nathan had a massive heart attack. And he really had more than that. He broke his hip in 1968. I don't want to get emotional here and have my tears on tape. And he broke his hip in 1968, cleaning and running a drain down the basement. And we took him to St. Joe, and it was supposed to be the best specialist going. But somehow, at that time, they were putting pins in. And he, his body rejected the steel. And 6 months after, it broke through, the pin broke through. He was always in pain, always, never got off of the crutches. And just had an awful time getting up out of a chair. We had to have special chairs, and we had to put a ramp out the front door that he could walk out, you know. And so we took him back, and we were taking him all the time. Every 6 weeks he was going, and the x-rays somehow showed that it was healing fine. It wasn't healing at all. And when it broke through, we had to take him back in the ambulance. Well, then they seen, and they pulled the pin out, and the marrow of his bone was just about like jello half congealed. It was just, so they had to go out, and he had to go then until late January and let that marrow rebuild itself. And then he had a plate put on the outside. But all in all, he was 2.5 years in wheelchair and crutches. But he just kept a fighting, and he just, as soon as he could get out, he'd go down his ramp, and he'd go, and finally he got so, but he never got away from the cane. And then he was just about to start back milking the cows, and thinking he was, getting along all right. And a cow in 1974, my brother hadn't been away for anything. He'd milked twice a day, 7 days a week for 2 years. So Native, the oldest son, wanted him to come go to a ball game. So Dickie was playing ball at Dover, and he was going to come and milk for Tom that night. But Nathan thought, well, I feel good, and so I'll feed the calves. And he fed the calves, and he fed the bull, and he put the milkers up and was getting everything ready so Dickie wouldn't be so late. It was on Saturday night. And had a prize bull, and he put out some feed in a little pan outside the gate. And the bull came up, and he sort of was gnawing around, and Nathan turned his back to come in the gate. And when he did, the bull lifted him up and broke his back. So back to the ambulance and the hospital again, and he was 51 days that time. He was 49 and when he had his massive heart attack, and they didn't really think he would ever live. In 51 days, again, he was in the hospital. And it was a year with a brace. I had to bathe him in bed for a year because he had to put this big steel brace all around for a year. And then he got better again. When the year was off come the brace. He went to driving again, and he did quite a few little chores. We called him retired, but when he died, we seen how not retired he was. He did all the little chopping in the garden. He took the times, you know. And it's still going. So as I say, in 1978, he was began to do fine. But of course, they told him he could never, he would never, because he had what they call myocardial infarction, and that part of his heart was dead. They dissolved the clot. A big clot was right in the center, and they dissolved until they got it down. I think it was, if the doctor told us right, it was a little bit bigger than a walnut, and that would always stay there. Yeah. So that way his work was curtailed. But he did get so he could milk again, but he never tried to. He never could raise tobacco or any hard work like that, you know, that was so strenuous. Oh, he did strip tobacco for a while after that, But then in 1978, as I say, he was doing real good. He always gave the cows a shot if they had mastitis, because Tom didn't trust himself. But Tom was really managing the farm and doing the work. And of course, we had to hire an awful lot in the tobacco. But Tom did all the cows, all the milking, and really done an excellent job, and never had too much experience with cows. He really made us a lot of good money. We hit right in the lucky years with the grade A system, and we really done well. And Tom would never leave him after that. After he went the time that Nathan broke his back, he never would. But he would consent for Nathan to do the shooting the cows, give them all their shots, and the heifers if they needed for their shots. Nathan did that because he just had a technique about him. And Tom didn't trust himself, and he come up this morning on February the 9th, 1978, and told him that this cow is starting mastitis, and I believe if you'd give her a shot, we would avoid it. So Nathan fixes his shot and goes down and to give the shot, and the cow hadn't been used to Nathan being around. And see, they're very sensitive of who takes care of them, just that one person had been. And she knew there was a stranger there, and she kicked back, and she kicked him, and about 4 inches below, and he fell like he was shot, and there his hip was broke again. The other one was right down here, and this one. So back to the ambulances and the hospitals, again we go, and he went to Lexington. But he had good luck with that bone. Oh, we were so fearful it'd be the same thing, but he had good luck. And they took the old pin out because that bone was so, and then put a new, not a pin, but a plate, a silver plate in the form of a T. So that remained with him then. But then he came back from that, and he still could do garden work, and he'd go to the mill, and he certainly enjoyed life right to the fullest until then he was stricken just suddenly on February the 4th, and he died. I was sitting out here, and I went in, he went in to call him to come to his dinner, and he got up, and I see he was not feeling very good, and I said, "Why don't you lie back down?" And he said, "No, I'll be all right when I get up and stir around," and that was so familiar. I'd heard that so many times, So I came on out and fixed his lunch, and then I looked at the clock and I realized that he should be out by that time, because by that time he had taken off his pajama top and had the button out of his pants of his pajama, and he always put his clothes over on his chair. And so I waited a few more minutes, and I didn't hear the bathroom water running or anything, so I went in and I didn't see him, and I thought, well, he must be in the bathroom. And I come back, but he attempted to get to the chair, and he fell between the chair, and he was gone.
Well, he didn't suffer then.
No,
that's
because I'd been talking to him 15 minutes before, and he was, fine. So, it was a terrible shot, although, we knew that he'd already, when we brought him home, the doctor, he didn't tell me, but he told Dolores, because she was a registered nurse, that... Oh, he said he will, if he lives without the end this year, he will get in pretty good shape. But 2 to 3 years will be the limit. And he said if he's lucky, and I know he'll get good care, he might make it 5, but it's very doubtful. He made it 11. So we knew that.
Don't show your doctors don't know her.
That's right. And we knew that we were lucky, and. We had got, Tommy was just getting out of high school when he had the heart attack. But as a